Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea, Ryan Gibson. Another week of financial education here. How you doing, Ryan?
I'm doing great. And what a guest do we have coming back after 151 episodes. We're bringing back Guy Adami, who's on the, he's the longest standing host on Fast Money. So if you watch, if you turn on this TV, if you're watching the back of the airplane, and if you're a pilot, you're probably looking in the airport as you walk through the terminal and you see this guy. No pun intended, Guy Adami on the show. He's the longest standing member of that show, and he is going to catch us up on everything we should be paying attention to in the market. So, Tate, what do we ask? What do we talk about today?
I mean, it's just a fantastic show. I think this is going to be one of those that you just get glued to because he's so well spoken. He's so unbelievably knowledgeable. We're talking about the public markets, which we don't do enough of on this show, national debt, you know, volatility in the market, where you want to be positioning your assets ahead of, you know, what's happening just in the U.S. government with money printing, what's happening with the Fed, the bond markets, everything. So really, really impactful episode. So Ryan, tell us more about Guy.
Yeah, so Guy has actually been a hedge fund manager. He lives in the Jersey, New York area, and, you know, he's on Fast Money every single night, and he's a friend of the show. Right. I actually have the opportunity to take my entire family out there and go to the NASDAQ and see where they filmed the show, and actually watched the Fast Money show get filmed and met the whole cast. By the way, the hosts of the show are some of the nicest people, most knowledgeable people you've ever met. It was just a super fun experience. I've got some fun pictures and photos of my kids sitting around the Fast Money
so great.
show table. So we're just so happy that he's a friend of the show. He's able to come on and educate our pilots. And in fact, I know a lot of the pilot community listens to Fast Money. And so it's just really fun to get a peek under the hood on what types of things, what does he actually study and read all day? We're going to have tons of great show notes in this episode. And what are some indicators that pilots should be looking at, and how closely should you be paying attention to the market? And Guy is going to really give us that perspective, you know, kind of a peek behind the curtain, so to speak. So with that, I'm really excited, Tate. Let's get into it.
Let's go. Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll. Guy Adami, welcome back to the show after, gosh, 3 years, huh?
Been a while. It's an honor to be back with you fellas, and congratulations on all your success. I've watched from afar, but I'm very proud of what you guys have put together.
Thank you,
sir. Yeah, you were on episode one, and now we're on about, I don't know, episode 150 plus. So we've been doing the thing for many, many weeks.
I'm bookending you guys. I love it.
Hopefully not. It's not a bookend.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I stand corrected.
But hey, it's great to have you back. The markets have been absolutely crazy these past few weeks. And so, it's been an incredible bull run since episode one. But gosh, there's definitely some volatility entering the market with the geopolitics and everything. So we're excited to get into it.
Let's get into it, because volatility has come back in a pretty significant way. And I think a lot of people that are sort of passive and watch the market, you know, a few times a week, if not less than that, will say, well, the only reason the market's down, the only reason the volatility is here is because of the war that now I think we're in our fifth week or so. And I think it's okay to call it a war. That is obviously, there's truth to that. But the reality is the volatility has sort of been percolating under the surface now for quite some time. It probably started in the fall of last year. And obviously it's made its way into what we've been seeing lately. So the war has obviously put an accelerant on things, but there were other things to be concerned about prior to what we've seen over the last month, month and a half.
Yeah, what is that? I mean, that was actually going to be my first question, which is what trends were trending the wrong way and are now more exacerbated by the war, and you know, kind of what do we have to be mindful of with that?
I think that's the exact right question. And one of the things that's been happening sort of in slow motion, but you know, we do still live in a global world in a global economy, I guess even more importantly for sake of this conversation. And if you've been watching around the edges, you've seen global bond yields. And when I say global, I mean pretty much all across the planet start to move higher. And this is an administration, and the first Trump administration openly talked about the want for yields to be lower. And he's been obviously very critical of this Federal Reserve since he took office. And prior to that, wanting them to lower rates. Now, I think what a lot of people think is if the Fed lower rates, rates go lower. I think both of you understand that it's not as simple as that. And quite frankly, the Fed has been lowering rates and 10-year yields, which are the important one to watch, have actually been going higher. So one of the things that I think have contributed to some of the volatility is some of this global credit concern, which is manifesting itself in higher yields across the planet. And as we sort of remove ourselves or try to isolate ourselves, and I'm not suggesting it's right or wrong, I mean, that's the course of action. The market is saying, you know what, we'll buy your bonds, but we're demanding a higher rate of interest to do so. And that's concerning because yields going higher for those reasons are not necessarily a good thing.
Yeah. And Guy, like the other thing I noticed too is, you know, I watched Fast Money yesterday, and one thing you said really stuck out with me, which is the overall market was down 9%, but some stocks are down as high as 26%. So one in every four stocks is sort of down, but you know, are these other stocks just really propping up the market, or are those stocks going to gain momentum? You know, it seems like it's a really lopsided market right now.
Well, thanks for watching, and it's been that way for a while. I mean, it's a market that's been dominated by 8 to 10 names that everybody knows by heart at this point, and that's been good enough to sort of support the broader market, because if you think about just the size of those companies, you're talking about multi-trillion-dollar companies, and then some companies that are approaching $1 trillion of market cap. So if they do well, the math suggests that the broader market's going to hold in there. But you know what you just stated is exactly right. One in four stocks are down somewhere between 25 and 40% off their all-time high. Now think of that for a second, because you just stated that. Anywhere from 25 to 40% off its all-time high. As you just said, Ryan, the broader market, the S&P 500, is down only 9% from its all-time high. So you have to ask yourself, all right, what's going on? Is there going to be a follow-through in the broader market that's going to get us to the levels that we're seeing in the majority of stocks, 25% of the stocks, or are those stocks an anomaly and they're going to start to play catch-up? Now, I think I know the answer to it, but obviously nobody knows. I think at some point the broader market plays catch-up, and we're in the midst of it now. Obviously, what's going on in the Middle East is not helping. I think there's a hope that if there's some sort of detente or whatever word you want to use, that will support the broader market. I think that will be true for a short period of time. But the underlying concerns have not gone away by any stretch of the imagination.
Guy, I want to bring up the Buffett indicator. This is the total stock market cap over U.S. GDP. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really interesting metric to look at. This is something that Warren Buffett looks at, basically taking total valuation of all the stocks in the United States over the gross domestic product of the United States. And it's at all-time highs. Mm-hmm. I want to get your sense, you know, is that just a function of it's a new reality today? This is just the reality of where we are in the market today. There's more money in the system, and so this is a new normal? Or do you think it's an effect of, you know, these mega cap stocks just getting completely overvalued with the AI boom and all that stuff going on?
Well, Tate, thank you for that. And you should put it in the show notes because I think it's really interesting. Warren Buffett, the Buffett indicator, you just explained it really well. It's basically the Wilshire 5000, which is all investable stocks divided by, as you said, GDP in the United States. And historically, Warren Buffett gets concerned when that gets north of 120%. As you just stated, we're well north of about 210%. So many standard deviations above what is concerning to him. So what has Warren Buffett done on the back of that? Well, Berkshire Hathaway is a $1 trillion market cap company. They currently have, I think, about $375 billion of cash sitting on their balance sheet. So what they're saying is there's nothing that we see that is that attractive, and we're going to sort of put this money away for a bit of a rainy day, and we're going to wait for it. Now, in addition to that, or what's been happening as a residual impact on that, is Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway is being punished. And the market is saying every day the market goes higher and you're not participating in it, we're going to punish you. Now, the question I think that remains to be answered, has the world passed Warren Buffett by? Is it different this time, to your point? Or is that Buffett indicator going to sort of be tried and tested and continue to pass the test of time? And at some point, I'm going to see some sort of resumption of normalcy. Now, what people will say is why it's different. It's a global market, to your point, and there's more cash sloshing around. Okay, I would agree with that. But the levels that we're seeing suggest something else is going on. And I think there's a level of concern with Warren Buffett. He did an interview with Becky Quick, and he talked about the market still being expensive. Now, a lot of people, again, will say that the reason why they have that much cash is because Warren is stepping aside and he's setting up the balance sheet and the company for the next guy in charge. I think Warren Buffett's the type of guy that, regardless of his age, he's going to play by the set of rules that he's played by historically.
Right.
Yeah. And Guy, you know, for most of our listeners, you know, they're not sitting around watching the market all day.
Nor should they be.
Right.
But there are a handful that do. So what do I got to be concerned about? If I'm a guy that doesn't sit around and watch the market all day, what is my short and long-term strategy?
Well, I mean, as you also know, depending on your age bracket, it's different for a lot of people. If you're a young person, if you're in your, let's call it 35 and younger, and you basically have just started your career, you shouldn't necessarily be watching this thing as often as I do, which is basically minute to minute. As a matter of fact, you should be passively watching it. But with that said, you should have an understanding of what you own. I think a lot of people will be surprised, is my sense, when they open their statements to see a stock market that's down, you know, 8-9% off its all-time high, but their portfolio might be worse than that. And why is that? Because a lot of the names that they own, they probably don't even realize that they own. And as we said earlier, many of these stocks are down anywhere from 25 to 40%. So understanding what you own, I think, is important. Whether you're doing it self-directed or you're doing it through an advisor, whatever it is, I think it's incumbent upon you to know what you own. Because if you don't, then when the sort of the other side of the mountain hits, you know, you can't then say, wait a second, what was I, you know, what happened here? Because you have to be educated. How often should they watch? Well, often enough where, again, there's an understanding of what's happening in the market, but not often enough that's going to keep them awake at night. But understanding what you own is critical. To answer your other part of the question, what you should be concerned about, that Buffett indicator, as Tate just brought up, is something you absolutely should be looking at. And what that means is there's no real valuation cushion for this market. So if there's some exogenous event or some existential risk that maybe we're living through right now, the market's not going to have the cushion that it would have if valuations were a little more normal. The other thing, and again, I don't know if you do show notes or not, but there's something called the cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio, which is the second highest reading in history. I think the largest, well, the highest one was somewhere in the late 1920s. And I think we all remember what was going on then. So a lot of these metrics are flashing warning signs, understanding that none of them are timing mechanisms, but you have to be aware. And the conversation around some of the things that you own shouldn't be a threatening one or an intimidating one. You should be able to talk to the person that's working with you and say, hey, I'm a little concerned about these things. What should we be doing to sort of mitigate the risk? Because pulling out of the market entirely is never a good idea, because the reality is once you pull out, it's very difficult to get back into the market. I think a lot of people learned the hard way in 08 and 09. Yep. But understanding what you own, I think, is vitally important for everybody listening or watching to this.
I got a question to balance the Buffett indicator. You know, there's some people that say, well, what about AI and robotics?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is potentially the largest leap in human productivity in our lifetimes. And this will just completely transform corporate earnings. What are your thoughts to that? Do you think it's overblown, or do you think that, you know, it is different this time because of the advent of AI?
All right. So I, you know, again, I don't think it's overblown. I do think AI is as disruptive a technology as we've seen in quite some time, but what does it necessarily mean? Now, there are people out there that's going to say it's going to enhance the workforce, and there may be some truth to that. Clearly, productivity is enhanced, but I think what you're seeing is, and whether people want to admit it or not, I think it's going to be a really difficult situation for the labor market. And when you're talking about an economy that's 70% driven by people basically buying stuff on the back of them having jobs, that's problematic. And if you're watching the headlines over the last couple months, you've seen some pretty large company with some pretty significant layoffs. It used to be called Square. I don't know what they call it now. Box, I guess. They just laid off 40% of their workforce. That's pretty significant. Facebook just announced a pretty significant labor force reduction. And you're seeing it around a lot of different companies. You're definitely going to see it in these Wall Street firms, and you're going to see it more than normal. And I think that's going to have an impact on the unemployment rate. And the unemployment rate is directly correlated with what's going to happen in the stock market. So I think once that genie's out of the bottle and once companies start laying off, that's a very hard thing to sort of turn around. And I think we're sort of on the precipice of that. So for all the gains you're going to get in productivity, which are significant, you're going to lose them on the back end, I think, in the labor market, which is not, I don't think, market friendly.
When do you think OpenAI and Anthropic go public?
Yeah, I think they probably would love to. I mean, you see the valuations that are being thrown around. My sense is they're not eager to do it right now in this environment. But the back half of this year, which we're basically, we're through the first quarter. So I think somewhere in the third or fourth quarter of this year, I think it's reasonable to think that that will come to market. Obviously, a lot of people vying for that. Both exchanges obviously want it. I think this is probably not the ideal environment, but if things sort of level off in the back half, I think, you know, you could potentially see this in the fall of 26.
Yeah, just circling back to like the layoffs and what this is creating and efficiencies are creating. I mean, obviously, it'd be great for the American public to be able to participate in the public market for both those companies. I mean, I just had a friend, you know, at Meta get laid off, $300,000 a year job. Right. And I mean, this is not, you know, someone losing their job at a lower income paying job. These are significant incomes. Yeah. And I agree with you. We're just at the beginning of it. I think we're going to see massive disruptions, which is going to have a trickle down for the airlines. Right. I mean, if Meta is not, you know, if they're not paying somebody $300,000 a year, you multiply that by the hundreds of jobs that were just lost in the Seattle market. Now, all of a sudden, people aren't going on vacations. They're not flying. Right. They're not doing a lot of things. So, I mean, how would you kind of speak to a pilot about, I mean, you know, yes, we our jobs are great right now. We have $500,000 to $1 million a year sometimes incomes. You know, AI is not really, you know, it might affect our jobs in the long run. But right now, I mean, we've got it pretty good. I mean, I almost kind of feel like, you know, I don't want to be a, you know, scare tactic here, but, you know, batten down the hatches, because, I mean, we might be having a significant reduction in labor force that is not going to fly in airplanes as much.
And you throw oil prices on there as well.
And you throw oil prices on it, which are, and then forget about, yes, oil price is extremely important. But, you know, what people don't talk about is the jet fuel costs and diesel fuel. And those things, they can't necessarily be passed on to the end consumer. So these companies are going to have to eat it. And when you say companies, Ryan's talking about airlines, and that obviously hurts margins. And airlines, Ryan, you know this, Tate, you probably know it as well, notorious for sort of ramping things up at the exact wrong time and then throttling back, no pun intended, at the other side of the equation, because they zig when they should zag. I think there's a couple things at work here. You just mentioned people losing their jobs. You know, the definition of a recession is when your neighbor loses his or her job. A depression is when you lose yours. And, you know, there are things out there that are definitely concerning. In terms of flying, though, I mean, just think about what's happening globally right now. There are people that I think are scared to travel for obvious reasons. Obviously, the TSA situation, I think, has people a little bit on edge. That will be resolved, but there's some concern around there. You guys can wax poetic about what's happening with the air traffic controllers. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why people would be reticent on top of the labor market and the economy, which may be showing signs of sort of waning a little bit. So look, the airline industry is cyclical, I think, whether people want to acknowledge it or not. It depends on what part of the cycle you think we're in. The stocks have done extraordinarily well. I mean, recently Delta Airlines made an all-time high. So they're trading as if everything is, you know, going gangbusters. But the reality is on the ground, there are obviously some things that they have to take into consideration.
Well, I think Scott Kirby was on the Bloomberg the other day talking about how the price hikes that they've put into place so far are covering about 60% of the increase in jet fuel prices, but we're only at $100 a barrel. They're pricing in a worst case scenario. They're cutting back schedules and they're battening down the hatches for $175 oil right now.
Think about that.
Worst case scenario.
Yeah. I mean, just think about what you just said. That's historic, and they're game planning out for that. And then the next question is, you know, what do they see that the market's not necessarily taking into consideration right now? And that, look, I get it, worst case scenario. And historically, you know, energy prices higher on the back of geopolitical events typically are somewhat short-lived. But this is seemingly lasting longer than I think a lot of people thought. I mean, again, not to be political because it bores the shit out of me, but I'm quite certain the administration thought on the heels of what happened in Venezuela that this foray into Iran would not take all that long. I think they thought, you know, given the firepower that we have, it was going to be a pretty short-lived situation. And obviously 5 weeks into this thing, I think it's proving to be anything but. And these elevated oil prices, are clearly concerning, regardless of what people in the administration say.
Yeah, it makes sense. Going back to the Anthropic and OpenAI going public, you know, when that happens, is it good to get in right away when it goes public? How do you kind of assess if it's the right investment to make right out of the box?
Yeah, that it's case by case, right? We've seen IPOs, a lot of excitement around it. The IPOs come out and 3 or 4 months later, you're saying, what the hell did I get myself into? And other things that never see, never look back. Again, I know you guys both know the answer to this. It really comes down to valuation and what the market's willing to pay for it. And should you get on back of it? And one of the things, it's that old thing. If somebody's selling you something, you have to ask, why are they selling it to you? And is this the right time? And the other thing you should watch for, and I cannot speak intelligently about those two companies, but what kind of insider selling is there going to be on the back of it? In other words, are they ringing the cash register on the back? Because if they're taking their money out, it might not necessarily be the right time to be putting your money in.
I think you'll maybe agree with me on this, that whenever there's a big new technology that comes out, there's usually a hype cycle where things get completely frothy and overblown. And then there's a big downturn and everybody goes, well, that didn't work. And then it slowly, it works its way into every part of human life over the next decade. You see this in the internet, the dot-com bubble. You see it in crypto, where it was this mania and then it crashed. And now blockchain is just slowly and quietly working its way into every facet of finance and logistics and things like that. Where do you think we are in that AI hype cycle? Or do you think it'll be more muted because it's just so radically useful?
I think I'll take sort of the other side. I think in the immediacy of the news cycle and with all the basically every story, at least on CNBC, you can't watch for 15 minutes without some sort of form of AI coming up on the news cycle. I think the hype is actually probably as high as it's ever been for anything that we've seen since CNBC basically came into existence. That includes the internet. I mean, people are jazzed up about this. And again, rightly so, to your point. It's just a question of, who are going to be the winners and losers in the next 5 years? Have they been established? Do we know who they are? Or is there going to be a new segment of stocks and companies that come out on the back of this? Is it going to be the picks and shovels, or is it going to be the open AIs and the Anthropics and those types of companies? A lot of spend out there, but you guys have seen this. I mean, the circular notion of the spend has been tremendous. Think about it. NVIDIA,
what are your thoughts on that?
NVIDIA invests in these companies. These companies then turn around and buy NVIDIA chips. Well, it's vendor financing. I mean, that's the term for it. At least that was the term for it was 25 or 30 years ago. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's not illegal, but it clearly should raise an eyebrow when, companies invest in companies only to see then those companies use those investment dollars to buy their products. I mean, again, the circular nature of this is, I think, something to keep in mind, because if one of the pegs, like that, what is that game the kids play, Jenga or something? If one of those things get pulled out, it could potentially pull out the entire ecosystem of what's going on right now. And it's all Anthropic, OpenAI, NVIDIA. They're seemingly the epicenter of everything.
I want to go back to the bond market, because the bond market and the labor market are kind of intertwined. You mentioned these $1 trillion companies. Some people don't realize that the global bond market is what, $145 trillion.
It's
the largest market in the world is the bond market. So where do you see this going in the next 5-10 years if there's a massive layoff wave as AI comes in and replaces jobs? And of course, I'm a believer that long term, just like any big technology that comes in, we're going to be better for it in 20 years from now, right?
Agreed,
but there's going to be a very rough period where people have to retrain. Their college degree isn't as useful anymore. What does that do to interest rates in 5 years if there's a big drawdown in the labor market, high unemployment?
Great question. In a slowing economy, assuming that that's what it means, one would think that interest rates, bond yields would go lower on the back of that. Historically, that's what's happened. And I think what's going on right now in terms of, in at least in our country, the 10-year yield, which is sort of the benchmark, you have this sort of tug of war in terms of what's going on. The deflationary aspect of AI and what it means to productivity in the labor force, that obviously should make yields go lower. The seemingly weakening economy, on a number of different metrics that should make yields go lower. The flip side, this global debt problem and global yields going higher. And then obviously what we've set up for ourselves here in the United States, this sort of isolationist thing that's going on, which also is bearish for the bond market. Right. So the bond market's trying to figure it out. And on any particular day, one side is seemingly winning. There are days where the isolationist global debt component seems to be winning with yields going higher. And there are other days where the flight to safety, slower economy, deflationary forces at work seem to be winning. And I think what's going to wind up winning, regardless of what the Federal Reserve does, is rates going higher, because I think the global debt problem is in fact a problem. But there are other people that think that yields are going to go markedly lower on the back of the things that you described. I wish I could tell you what's going to happen. You know, I'm trying to game it out myself, but I think in the end, debt wins.
Speaking of debt and interest rates, I mean, with potentially spiking inflation again, you know, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, with all the war and the spend and, you know, the oil, I mean, what are your kind of short-term thoughts on inflation and what it does to, you know, kind of the overall market?
Yeah, inflation is a funny thing. And all administrations seem to make the same mistake. They try to tell people that how they should be feeling, and don't tell people how they should feel. They know how they feel. And when you hear, again, this is apolitical, but when you hear whatever administration, whatever pundit come out and say, we're winning the war on inflation, inflation is going lower, that's not really what's happening. I think you both know this. All that's happening is inflation is going up less fast, if that's a term. And the cumulative impact on inflation, people feel it. So we are not at a point now where you could say we're winning. It's not as bad as it was in terms of the rate of change, but it's still a problem. And you're feeling it in everyday life. And obviously what's going on in the Middle East with energy is clearly not going to help it. If anything, it's just going to continue to be a problem. I think a lot of people thought inflation in 2026 would not be an issue. I think the Federal Reserve was one of those groups. It clearly still is. It's a problem for this administration. The cost of living is problematic, and I don't see it waning anytime soon. That's just me. And I'm not wishing that. And again, you know, you got to be careful in a rate cutting environment, which we are theoretically in, although the market now is pricing in potentially no rate cuts the rest of the year. What are you doing here? You know, you're cutting rates in an inflationary, where inflation's still a problem. You're playing with fire a little bit, for sure.
And it's such a tug of war, right? Because on one hand, AI, robotics, highly deflationary, huge productivity gains potentially, and, you know, upward pressure on asset prices and stocks and companies are going to do really well, while the average person is on the other side of the equation calling for rates to come down. You know, so it's this bizarre tug of war, this barbell.
Well, you guys know the housing market because, you know, you're very familiar with what's going on in your world. I will tell you, I mean, obviously affordability is, I think, and you probably have the stats in front of you, I think the average age for the first time home buyer in the United States is now in the mid 40s, which about that for a second. I think this is historical in terms of the age, how old people are. And that speaks to affordability. So people think that if you can just get rates down, that will somehow help the housing market. And maybe there's some truth to that. Obviously, the headwinds of higher rates will abate. But the problem is, why are rates coming down? Is it because the labor market's deteriorating? So you just said it. It's this tug of war that's going on. It's you fix one thing and you screw something else up. Right. So I don't necessarily know how it plays out. I would hope that, you know, if Kevin Warsh is in fact the person that comes in May or June, I think he's smart enough to understand what's going on. And despite the fact that the administration is going to beat the shit out of him probably on a daily basis to lower rates, I don't know if he's going to acquiesce. So we'll see. But the bond market, you know, again, the Fed controls the front end of the curve. They don't control anything else. And the bond market has been raising rates on its own for the last however many months.
Let's talk about that, because I don't think that's something that's widely known or understood.
Well, I'll say it. And you know, the Fed, as much as we like to think, and I, as a layperson, I would understand that if the Fed's lowering rates, that means rates are going lower. And that's true sometimes, but by definition, it's not necessarily true. And quite frankly, if you just look at when the Fed has lowered rates, the knee-jerk reaction in the bond market has actually been to sell off the bond market or to make rates go higher. So the market controls the back end of the curve. The Fed controls the front. And I think there's a hope that if they keep enough pressure on the front end, that the back end is going to cooperate. And the exact opposite has been happening. And what winds up happening without making people's eyes glaze over is the yield curve continues to sort of move out. The yield curve continues to expand. And historically, that could be a good thing because it historically speaks to an economy that's doing well. But if rates are going higher for the wrong reasons, that's not necessarily a good thing. And I would submit that rates are not going higher because the economy is so robust. They're going higher for more nefarious reasons. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. And the Fed officials know this, whether or not they acknowledge it or not, they get it. They don't control the back end. I think this is an administration that either knows it and doesn't admit it or doesn't know it, which is problematic in and of itself. But the Fed could come out and lower rates at any point today, and that doesn't necessarily mean the bond market is going to react in kind. As a matter of fact, if the bond market senses that they're doing it out of some sort of, you know, Hail Mary type of thing, the bond market will punish them on the back of that.
And I want to point out here, just as another layer of education, who's controlling, you know, we say the market, right? But it's literally treasury auctions, right? So it's other countries buying U.S. debt. And so if nobody shows up, those rates go up. And so
we just had one of the shittiest, if I may use that term, short-term bond auctions we've seen in a long time last week. And you just hit the nail on the head. And this is, it's going to be hard for people to hear. And I'm sure there are people that don't want to hear this. But, you know, when we talk about holding all the cards, it's not necessarily true, because when people own your debt, you don't own all the cards. They sort of does. The market sort of does right now. So, you know, you mentioned it in the form of the Buffett indicator. We're $39 trillion in debt right now. That's a staggering number that's seemingly going up exponentially now. The debt service on that alone is a problem. And, you know, the bond market
is the defense budget.
Significantly, the bond market is a confidence game. And, you know, if you've set yourself up to be an isolationist nation and you give people options other than the U.S. debt market, I mean, look, I'm not suggesting we're going to have a failed auction. That's not my point. But I said it earlier in the show and I'll say it now. What it means is market participants are going to demand a higher rate of interest to buy our debt. And that's what we're seeing, I think.
Guy, I want to shift gears a little bit and take a peek behind the scenes. You're obviously on Fast Money every day. You've had tons of experience in the market, hedge fund manager, et cetera. How do you prepare yourself to educate yourself? You said you're in things minute by minute. You've given us a couple of things for the show notes. What's kind of like your day like that, you know, what indicators do you look at that we can kind of share with our listeners that we can kind of follow along with?
Well, I appreciate that. So natural curiosity takes you a long way in life. And for me, the majority of my day is spent just sort of reading and trying to understand what's going on and trying to connect dots. You got to, unfortunately, it's not necessarily just looking at things going on here in the United States. You got to be paying attention to what's going on in other countries. Japan has been sort of this sort of thorn in my side now for the last year for a myriad of different reasons, but it's just being curious about things and just trying to get yourself up to speed. So what I say all the time, and I appreciate your question, the market is humbling. There's no more humbling entity than the United States stock market or the global market or the bond currency, whatever it is. It does it on a daily basis. So for me, it's going to happen by definition, but there's no reason to be, or there's no excuse to be wrong factually. So I try to do my homework. I try to prepare as best I can. I try to read as much as I can, understanding that you're not going to be on top of everything, but you do the best you can. And 24 hours is a long time. So I just spend a lot of time reading and trying to figure out what the blank is going on in the world, understanding that even if I think that I know, I'll come up with the wrong conclusion in terms of where the market's going to go.
But at least it was factually backed. What are your top five sources that you're just go to? What are the first things you open?
So FactSet, there's a within FactSet, publicly traded company, Street Accounts is something that I look at, Bloomberg, Wall Street Journal, New York Times. There's some other, you know, some sort of internet-y based things. The Information is something that I look at. I mean, those are the ones off the top of my head. And those seemingly are helpful, because what winds up happening is, you know, you go down those rabbit holes and then they lead to another rabbit hole, right? So you know, those being sort of the main things that I look at, always then sort of take you in other directions. And then earnings releases, you got to sort of go through those to the extent that something comes up that's interesting. And it's just sort of paying attention to what's going on in the markets and trying to be sort of, try to be mindful of all the forces at work. And unfortunately, in today's world, in a headline-driven world, there are certain things out there that are completely out of your control.
Right. I want to talk about Bitcoin. What are your thoughts on Bitcoin?
I will tell you, I've tried to understand it. I don't understand the utility. I think Bitcoin was born in the financial crisis by whomever as a sort of a way to fight central banks that have run amok in fiat currencies. And I think that was the genesis of it. I think if you overlay a Bitcoin chart, it overlays really well with how the Fed is behaving, a very accommodative Fed that Bitcoin seems to do better, a Fed that's seemingly more hawkish, Bitcoin seems to be worse. But something's happened, obviously, now over the last 4 or 5 months since the November election, when Bitcoin made an all-time high, seemingly on the back of an administration that was going to be very crypto-friendly. Bitcoin has been basically been cut in half over that period of time. And in an environment where gold has recently made an all-time high, pulled back a little bit, Bitcoin is significantly off its recent all-time high. Now, the question is, what's going on? And I think part of it is an understanding that, you know, maybe it's not going to be Bitcoin that's going to be the winner in all this thing. Maybe it's going to be something else. Maybe it's Ethereum, or as Tate mentioned earlier, just sort of blockchain. Maybe that's going to be the thing that sort of emerges. Or maybe it's going to be this Solana, things that things are built upon. But you have to be concerned that Bitcoin is meandering here in the mid 60,000s. Now, MicroStrategy, formerly MicroStrategy, I think you're familiar with what's been going on there. Michael Saylor, the CEO, I think he's the chairman now, I think on their balance sheet are currently 715,000 Bitcoin at an average price of just north of $76,000 a Bitcoin. So when Bitcoin was north of 100,000, they looked like geniuses. Now they're underwater. And the market, I think, is, in my opinion, testing the resolve of Strategy right now. And they haven't blinked yet. But there's a price where whether or not they want to blink, they're going to be forced to blink. And I think that to a certain extent is what Bitcoin is sniffing out right now.
3 years ago, you were on our show. What was something that has most surprised you in those last 3 years that you didn't think was going to happen? Or what was the biggest takeaway in the last 3 years?
AI, without question, the emergence of AI. Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty obvious one.
Sure.
I think something we probably talked about then, but is still obviously pervasive now, the impact of passive investing on the market and what it's done, to Tate's earlier point, you know, passive investing, money makes its way into the market regardless of what we just spent the last 30 minutes talking about, because it doesn't take those things into consideration. They're not important. But what it also does, it extends valuations, and the Buffett indicator is one of those things. So not understanding, and this is me, not you, not understanding how important passive investing is and the impact that it's had, that's something that I clearly missed.
What do you mean about when you say passive investing?
Well, think about just what people do on every day, the amount of money that makes its way into retirement accounts on a daily basis.
Just so you're talking ETFs,
funds, ETFs, mutual
target date funds, mutual funds,
all those different things, right? Just money flowing in, seemingly independent of what's happening in the outside world. They don't take it. Passive investing theoretically doesn't care about all the things we talked about. Now, the problem, of course, is if passive were to come active, it's never active on the way up. It becomes active on the way down. And I think that's something that we've seen it around the edges, but we haven't seen it in a meaningful way.
Right.
Right now, I kind of feel like I don't know where to put my money. You know, it's kind of like Bitcoin is down. Real estate seems to be, you know, a little bit sluggish, right, with interest rates. Mm-hmm. The stock market, like you said, what do you do? You got stocks that are 26% down. You got some that are overvalued. ETFs. I mean, everything kind of feel gold that just got crushed. Where do you get bullish? What are you excited about in the market that you're all in on?
Well, I mean, gold's been a monster, but I understand that the majority of people listening to this are not going to be involved in gold, and I totally get it. Energy stocks have done really well, and people will point to what's going on in crude oil, and obviously the Middle East is sort of this catalyst, but I think that's clearly part of it, but that's been sort of waiting to happen for a while. But to specifically answer your question, I think you have to be tactical. And, you know, Tate said it, and I think you're feeling it. Things potentially a little overextended here. And what does that mean? It means you sort of wait in the weeds until things get to levels that you deem to be interesting, whether it's the S&P 500 at a certain level or individual names at a certain level, and try to be tactical, understanding that most people don't have the time or the patience to do it. And I get it, because people have day jobs, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't be paying attention. So instead of being in these funds that, again, just sort of mindlessly put money into the market, which, by the way, has worked out really well, maybe take a step back and say, okay, that's worked, but maybe it's not going to work as well going forward. Maybe there's this new paradigm and valuations are going to matter. So try to find a list of things that you deem interesting and at prices that you would be willing to buy them at, regardless of what's going on in the outside world.
I've been dying to talk about this. So $39 trillion in debt.
Yeah.
We had Peter Linneman on the show, and he, you know, he's very not concerned about the national debt, because when you look at the resources that the U.S. has,
I get it.
When you look at that debt load per capita, it's not that bad, you know, a few grand per adult. What are your thoughts on that? Because we are over 100% now of debt to GDP.
We broke the
100% threshold, because what is the U.S. GDP, like 31 trillion?
I think it's a little north of 30. We'll call it 31, but we're 39. So
there's some people say Japan. Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but I mean, Japan is at what, 240%?
240, yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, is the indicator really flashing red, or is this not as big a deal as people think?
Yeah, fair. And I understand why people would discount it for the metrics you just said. I will tell you, historically, 130% of debt to GDP is where it's that point of no return, that if you go back and look over the course of history, and you'll say, well, wait a second, Japan's 240%. Yeah, but look at what's going on in Japan right now. They have a bond market that's been deteriorating. They have a currency that's been weakening. Those two typically don't go hand in hand. So, you know, there's going to be a day of reckoning coming there. And I think we're seeing it in slow motion. So I understand why people would say you shouldn't be concerned about it. It's different this time. I'm not one of those people. Like, history is a long time to sort of go back and look at data. And I think we're bumping up against a level that's going to be problematic. And it's not to say that the dollar is not going to be the reserve currency going forward, although there are four or five countries out there, maybe more, would want nothing more than to see that and to try to make it happen. But I think we have to be mindful of what's going on. And at some point, it's a problem. And, you know, you can't just sort of continue down this course and it's going to be the next guy or gal's problem, because at some point it's going to be somebody in the current seat's problem.
Well,
I think we're precariously close to that.
If that's the case, and it's sort of what we're setting up for here, you know, really there's three ways to take care of the debt. You can raise taxes. And
not going to happen.
Not going to happen. You can, stop spending so much money.
Which is not, you not can grow happen. Your way out of it. Not
you can
happen.
Grow your way out of it, which might.
Or what's the one that nobody talks about, but this is at. You
print
can
money.
Devalue your currency.
Exactly. You print money, you devalue your currency. So my bet is that's because that's the least bad for the politicians of all three options, right? So, you know, if that's the case, we devalue the currency, that means that hard assets go up in value, right? So
100%.
That's kind of how I think of it, is I want as much cash into hard assets as possible over the next, you know, 10, 20 years, because those things are going to do well when the currency devalues.
Real estate, gold, whatever the hell it is. Yeah, assets, even stocks. I mean, you could say...
And stocks, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, but I think you understand that you're playing with fire with that. You know, you could play that game where, you know, if you owe somebody $100, you want what you owe them to be worth less, right? I mean, that's the game. And I think a lot of countries have sort of been playing that game. Treasury Secretary Bessent openly talks about it. In the first Trump administration, President Trump was the first president that I can recall that it would actually say the U.S. dollar is too strong. And you know what? I understand exactly what he meant. I was shocked that he said it because, you know, you hear about the want for a strong dollar policy, which, by the way, is bullshit when you have the debt problem that we have. But the question is, I think the one that, again, needs to be answered, like, you want to play that game where you devalue your currency? Okay, I'll go along with that. But there's going to be a point where things start to break. We obviously haven't seen it yet, but if you continue to go down that sort of path, that's a slippery slope.
Yep. Yeah, because eventually people aren't going to show up to the auctions, right? Because you know, nobody wants to buy your debt at a 4%, 5% yield if you're devaluing your currency at a rate of 7, right? So
I mean, I don't think people know this. I think you both probably do. Since the end of World War I, somewhere in between, U.S. dollar has lost 90% of its value over that period of time. Think about that for a second. And you see it. I mean, people say, my parents bought a house for $6,000 in, you know, 1965.
Right.
Yeah, okay. You know why? Because think about what the currency has done over that period of time. Right. So that is the hidden tax. You talk about a hidden tax on people, that's the one that nobody wants to acknowledge.
And it's driving political behavior too. I mean, it's driving elections. I mean, housing affordability is the number one concern that, you know, the Gen Zs have, which is driving who we elect and how we tax our citizens. And it's creating a new world. I mean, it's really, yesterday, you know, Washington State passed a millionaire's income tax, 9.99% on anything over a million. This is, you know, the fundamental issue is affordability of housing. And I can't think that's understated. And until we come up with a policy to build more houses, that's what, I mean, you can lower the rate, but you're just going to drive up prices because now people are willing to borrow more and take more, and there's more money coming in until we build more.
Right.
That's really what's going to solve the issue.
There's no quick fix there. I mean, it comes down to exactly what you just said, you know, build more, but you know, with that requires labor, which is not readily abundant. Right. I mean, there are a lot of factors. I mean, it's a multifaceted conversation. And again, politics make their way into it, but immigration, if you think about it, I mean, who's building these homes? I mean, those are the labor force that you need. And if they're not readily available, then even if you want it, even if you have the land to do it and the resources to do it, you need people with basically the hammers in his or her hand, and you just don't have enough of them.
Yeah.
Well, if you're listening to the show, you're obviously in a very advantageous position. You're making a lot of money right now. And I think the story here is, as a long-term disciplined investor, you want to buy assets and own assets because, you know, in times of inflation, in times where currency is being devalued, you know, borrowers are rewarded and asset owners are rewarded. And it's sad because that is going to continue to, you know, widen the divide between the rich and the poor, the haves and the have-nots. But it's just, unfortunately, it's where we are, and we're kind of stuck because the wealthy have assets and the assets go up in value during times of inflation, and the middle class and the poor, you know, get hit really hard. And we can see that in this sort of K-shaped economy. So anyway, story there is keep buying assets, keep doing good work, and keep flying airplanes until AI takes over, right?
Hopefully no time soon. I'd rather have you two in the cockpit, to be honest with you.
Me too.
Well, thanks, Guy. Yeah, and thanks for coming on, Guy. You know, Guy, I know you have a podcast, Risk Reversal. Does it come out is it weekly?
We have a daily show at 11 a.m. Eastern time on YouTube. We're up to 130,000 YouTube subs, which it's big. I mean, we've done that in less than a year. And we have the Risk Reversal podcast. It's, you know, a few times a week comes out. And you can check us out on YouTube or the Risk Reversal channel, I guess, at your favorite podcast store. I hate saying that, but that's what people say.
Beautiful. Well, we'll link to that in the show notes.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Guy.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on.
Continued success, fellas. Thank you.
Same to you.
Have a good one.